Author James Howard Kunstler reads Social Relations and the Dilemmas of Difference from Chapter 9 of Too Much Magic.
Years ago, I had a girlfriend whose family owned a place on Lake George, a liquid memento of the last ice age that cuts majestically through the eastern Adirondacks. It wasn't just a house, it was an impressive compound of the type called a camp in the local vernacular. By this, they did not mean a children's summer camp, or a bivouac for loggers, but a very substantial and permanent establishment built for a single family. It had several outbuildings, but not quite enough of them to qualify for the uppermost category of these things, a great camp. Only a dozen or so Adirondack great camps were ever built for a very few super plutocrats of the 19th century. They gave them fanciful names. Their way, I suppose, of imbuing these grandiose dwellings with some historical afterglow as a counterpoint to their actual raw, bright, perhaps ill-gotten newness. J.P. Morgan called his Uncas after the noble Sachem in The Last of the Mohicans. The Vanderbilts owned Sagamore next door. One lake over, that is. Collis P. Huntington of the Southern Pacific Railroad enjoyed himself at Camp Pine Knot on Racket Lake. The great camps were built in the log and twig style, both inside and out, operated like medieval villages with their own workshops, gardens, dairies, laundries, stables, and other practical dependencies to support the lords of capital so far from the regular swim of civilized life. In those days, you didn't just drive to the Walmart with a shopping list. Of course, there were hordes of servants, everything from hunting guides to liveried waiters, gardeners, valets, nursemaids, cooks, and scullery girls, many living on the premises. Before the age of labor-saving machines, some people saved the labor of other people. To the generations that followed, the unfairness of that system may seem outrageous. I'm not sure that it was worse than the current disposition of things in the USA. My ex-girlfriend's family place was not such a great camp as to have had a storybook name, though it did eventually acquire some historical luster. It was built starting in 1898 over a period of a few years, mostly in the wintertime, when a horse-drawn sled could transport materials and workers across the frozen lake to the remote site on a point of land otherwise inaccessible by road. The great-grandfather who built it was a successful paint manufacturer from Long Island. He allegedly dallied with Broadway chorus girls at the Lake George place when great-grandma wasn't around, and there were stories about finding lots of champagne bottles stashed in the basement long after his demise. Inside, the place had 7 bedrooms and 1 bathroom. Under the circumstances, any indoor plumbing in such a remote spot was a kind of miracle, though the toilet drained into a leach field that surely ended up percolating into Lake George. The bedrooms were spacious and airy, with bead and board wainscoting throughout. The kitchen was a dark room at the rear of the house, mostly the realm of a domestic worker. Preparing meals in 1900 was not the artistic recreation it has been for us. It was work. The place was designed to operate with servants. This was an era when 6% of the working people in America were domestic servants of one kind or another. Without them, the place eventually slid into a long cycle of dereliction. By the time I came along, mice, yellow jackets, and fungal microorganisms were feasting on the place. The big house was a near ruin. Magnificent as it was, and the location was mind-blowing, including a lovely sheltered private cove to swim in, staying there was more like camping than going to a civilized country house. Even the rattlesnakes that had been driven to near extinction around their microhabitat of Tongue Mountain were turning up regularly again. What impressed me most was how a place built to endure had so sadly, utterly failed to. An air of desperate neglect and incompetence engloomed it. Nobody really took care of anything anymore. The social structure it was designed to exist in had dissolved too. The sad gestalt of the situation always put me in a mood to reflect on the current state of American society. The United States, like the house on Tongue Mountain, had become a kind of wreck. Nobody took care of anything. The whole nation was sliding into dereliction and ineptitude. The old gag that you can't find good help anymore was not so funny now. Even relatively well-off, intact families lived in chaotic households, with both parents off working to service mortgages, car loans, and revolving credit card debt, and the laundry piling up, and no regular mealtime, just everybody eating alone by raiding the refrigerator. If you wanted household help, you pretty much had to hire an illegal alien. And that didn't always work out so well on a casual labor basis, since a certain quasi-familial allegiance is needed to cement mutual trust. America looked like hell, the product of a zillion bad choices over many decades. Too many shitty buildings, too many paved-over cornfields, and now the whole kit and caboodle was past its design life. The shabby physical condition of the United States in the 21st century mirrored its social condition, just as the outward appearance of so many citizens signified frightful breakdowns, abuses, imbalances, and pathologies in their bodies. A range of social and political forces had especially deconstructed the lower echelons in the division of labor, so that the few remaining available adult roles to choose between were, one, minimum wage employee of a cruel and remote super gigantic corporation, such as Walmart or McDonald's, two, social services client, hostage to a cruel and remote bureaucratic, quote, safety net, including food stamps, minimal medical care, and meager cash handouts, three, participant in the outlaw underground economy, trafficking in drugs, sex, usurious money lending, and other crude larcenies. America, in 2011, had huge pretenses about social equality and equally huge tensions over the inequalities that indeed actually separated vocational, ethnic, and regional groups, despite the great social justice campaigns of the late 20th century. The living conditions, diets, daily routines, and social relations of today's hard-up classes may actually be a lot worse than those of yesteryear's servant class.